ever feel like you're just drowning in information. You really want to get a handle on something, understand it properly, but it's just too much, too complex.
Yeah, totally overwhelming sometimes.
Well, that's exactly why we do the deep dive. We're here to sort of guide you through it, sift through the complex stuff, like the great material you sent us, and pull out the core ideas, the important bits. Basically, a shortcut to getting properly informed.
Exactly. And today, we're diving into something that, well, it might sound a bit heavy at first,
Yeah.
the Riemann-Hilbert problem.
Right.
But hang on. Before your eyes glaze over thinking about math class, trust us. Even if the name's a bit intimidating, the ideas behind it, and how people figured it out, it's actually a fascinating story. Lots of twists.
It really is. We've been digging into the book, The Riemann-Hilbert Problem, by Anisov and Bolibrook for this one. It's pretty thorough. Our mission today, to really get the essence of it. Where did it come from? What are these key ideas, like fusion systems, regular systems? What were the big hurdles? And why is it still a big deal in math today? Okay, let's get into it.
Right. So the Riemann-Hilbert problem, because it's these two huge names, Riemann and Hilbert. But interestingly, the way it was actually formulated is, well, a bit more complicated than you might think. Riemann himself didn't quite state the problem as we know it.
Wait, really? The Riemann-Hilbert problem wasn't actually laid out by Riemann? That's
No.
unexpected. How did his name get attached then?
Well, Klein, another big name in math, he pointed out that Riemann talked about certain functions, ones with specific problem spats, singularities, and how they behaved when you trace paths around them. That's the monodromy part. He talked about them almost like their existence was just obvious.
Obvious.
Yeah, Klein's famous quote is that Riemann spoke carelessly about it. Then later, Hilbert, when he laid out his famous 23 problems back in 1900, he specifically said Riemann presumably was thinking on this problem. And then Röhrl, later on, really solidified that connection, linking Hilbert's 21st problem directly back to Riemann's thinking.
So it's kind of like a mathematical hand-me-down. Riemann had these big ideas. Hilbert saw how important they were, and then others shaped it into a specific challenge.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, the folks working in this area generally agree that the problem really stems from Riemann's work, his whole approach to complex analysis. So maybe not a direct line, but the intellectual heritage is definitely there. It's strong.
Okay, that makes more sense. Fascinating bit of history, though. So, what was Hilbert's 21st problem then? The one they tackled in Riemann's spirit?
Hilbert's 21st from that 1900 Congress was specifically about linear ordinary differential equations, working in complex domain, you know?
Ooh.
And he was focused on equations that with these specific kinds of singularities called fusion singularities and also a predefined monodromy group.
Fusion singularities. Okay, that sounds technical. Can we break that down a bit?
Sure. So imagine an equation describing something changing, right?
Oh.
A singularity is just a point where the equation kind of goes haywire, behaves strangely.
Right.
A fusion singularity is a particular type of strangeness, almost a mild type. Technically, it means the coefficients in your equation might blow up, have a pole, but it's only a simple pole, order one at most. Think of it like a small contained glitch. And a whole system of equations is called fusion, if all its singular points are this relatively tame fusion type.
Okay, so fusion means the glitches are sort of controlled, not too wild.
Got it.
Got it. Now, what about this monodromy group part?
Right, monodromy. That describes what happens to the solutions of these equations if you follow them along a path that loops around one of these singular points.
Okay.
Imagine you have a solution that works fine in a small area. If you expand it, analytically continue it along a closed loop around a singularity and come back to your starting point, the solution might actually have changed. It might be transformed. And that transformation, you can represent it with a matrix. The monodromy group is just the collection of all the possible transformation matrices you can get by taking all sorts of Platesian types of loops around all the singularities. It's kind of like a fingerprint showing how the solutions get mixed up by the singularities.
So the monodromy captures this sort of shuffling or scrambling of solutions as they navigate these tricky points.
Exactly. Different equations, even different solutions sometimes can have different monodromy. Although there's this idea of the universal covering surface. Basically, a way to unwrap things so the solutions behave more predictably locally, but the overall effect of looping is still captured by the monodromy group.
Okay, I think I'm getting it. So Hilbert's 21st problem basically asks, if someone gives you a list of singularities and tells you exactly how they want the solutions to get shuffled, the monodromy, can you always find a fusion system that does the job?
That's the essence of it, yes. a very specific question. And, you know, for quite a while, people thought their answer was yes, largely thanks to Joseph Plemelje's work around 1908.
Plemelje, what did he do?
He provided a positive solution to a very closely related problem. But instead of requiring this system to be fusion, he worked with a broader category called regular systems.
Regular systems. Okay. How are they different from fusion ones?
Good question. A system is regular at a singularity if its solutions don't grow too fast as you approach that point. Specifically, no faster than some polynomial rate if you approach along a straight line or within a sector.
Polynomial growth. Okay.
Fusion systems are always regular, but regular systems can be a bit trickier. For instance, a regular system might have solutions involving logarithms. And logarithms, if you approach the singularity along a spiral path, can actually grow faster than any polynomial. Fusion singularities don't allow that kind of logarithmic behavior directly in the solution structure. So fusion is a stricter condition.
So Plemelje solved it for this bigger, slightly less strict category of regular systems, but Hilbert specifically asked for fusion.
Exactly. So Plemelje's work, while a huge deal, a remarkable achievement, as the book calls it, wasn't a direct yes to Hilbert's original question about fusion systems.
Ah, okay.
His theorem became incredibly fundamental. The book points out that pretty much all the successful constructions of fusion systems for Hilbert's problem start by using Plemelje's theorem to build a regular system first. Then, the challenge is to tweak that regular system, modify it somehow, to make it fusion without changing the singularities or the crucial monodromy behavior.
Ah, I see. So Plemelje built the essential foundation. He gave mathematicians a starting point, this regular solution that they could then try to refine into the specific fusion one Hilbert wanted.
Precisely. And it's not just the theorem itself. Apparently, even specific techniques from his proofs are still relevant today. The proof strategy in the book actually builds on later work by Rural in 57 and others, but the Plemelje connection is undeniable.
So what kind of tools do you need for these proofs? You mentioned Rural.
Well, one really key piece of machinery is something called the Birkhoff-Groth-Endieck theorem. It's about the structure of complex analytic vector bundles over the Riemann sphere.
Vector bundles. Okay, that sounds pretty abstract again. Can you give us the quick version of why they matter for differential equations?
Yeah, it does sound abstract, but there's a really neat connection. You can think about a system of linear differential equations as defining a connection on a vector bundle over the Riemann sphere. A vector bundle is like attaching a vector space, a little coordinate system, to every point on your surface.
Okay.
And the monodromy of the differential equation, it corresponds exactly to the monodromy of this connection on the vector bundle. How parallel transport changes as you go around loops. So understanding the structure of these bundles, which is what Birkhoff-Groth-Endieck helps with, it says they break down into simpler pieces called line bundles, becomes crucial for figuring out if you can find a fusion connection with the right monodromy. The book uses an elementary proof by Leiterer, which is nice.
Right, right. So the geometry of these bundles tells you something about the existence of the kinds of equations Hilbert was looking for. Interesting. Okay, so we have the history, the fusion versus regular distinction, Plemelje's big step, and now this vector bundle perspective. So, did they eventually crack it? Did they solve Hilbert's 21st for fusion systems?
Well, yes and no. It turns out the answer isn't always yes, at least not in the way Hilbert probably intended. The big catch is that sometimes you can construct a fusion system with a required monodromy, but only if you allow yourself to introduce extra singularity.
Extra singularities. But Hilbert specified the singular points, didn't he?
He did. These extra ones are called the parent singularities. They look like singularities if you just stare at the coefficients of the differential equation, but the actual solutions behave perfectly fine around them. There's no branching, no monodromy associated with them.
Huh. So they're like fake singularities you have to add just to make the math work out for the fusion form, even though they don't affect the solution behavior you care about?
Pretty much. And Hilbert's original problem statement didn't seem to allow for these. You were supposed to use only the singularities given initially. So this was a major complication. The book also talks about something called the instability of fusion weight, which is another subtlety.
Instability of fusion weight. What's that about?
The fusion weight is basically a number you can calculate for a fusion system related to its complexity at the singularities. Instability means that sometimes making a tiny change to the monodromy you want can flip the answer. Suddenly, a fusion system can't exist without apparent singularities, even if one existed for the slightly different original monodromy.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and the book actually lays out specific counterexamples to Hilbert's 21st, especially when the monodromy representation is reducible. meaning it kind of breaks down into independent parts. There are theorems, like 5.3.1 and 6.1.1, that give precise conditions involving this reducibility Jordan blocks and this fusion weight concept. For when the answer is definitively no, you cannot find a fusion system without adding apparent singularities.
So that initial hope after Plumlj's work, it kind of ran into these fundamental roadblocks. Hilbert's question was trickier than it looked, and sometimes the answer was just no.
Exactly. It became clear it was much more nuanced. And the book also credits folks like Lapo-Danileschi and Deckers. They had important results around this time, too. Apparently, they didn't immediately claim to solve the Riemann-Hilbert problem, maybe because everyone thought Plumlj had already done it, but their work had direct consequences for understanding fusion systems.
It sounds like solving this involves zooming in really close to the singularities, the local theory, but also keeping the big picture, the global view in mind. The book covers that local stuff too, right? Near the singularity.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right.
You really need to understand what the solutions look like right near a singular point. This often involves thinking about that universal covering surface again, locally. And a really important idea here is called Levelt's basis, or Levelt's fundamental system of solutions.
Levelt's basis. What's special about that?
It's a particular choice of basis solutions near the singularity that reveals the structure very clearly. It connects to what's called the Poincaré representation, which the book writes as EXAAT. Here, $1 is the solution matrix, ZX is nicely behaved, and 6ET, which is like ELLNDA, contains this constant matrix H that holds the key information about the monodromy around that point. Levelt's basis refines this and helps define the exponents of the system, BETAC, Planck plus MOOC, which tell you precisely about the growth and oscillatory behavior near the singularity.
So the local theory gives you this detailed microscopic view at each trouble spot. And how does that link back up to the global picture, the whole Riemann sphere and the vector bundles?
Right, that's where it connects beautifully. The whole Riemann-Hilbert problem, asking for a fusion system, is equivalent to asking, can we find a holomorphic vector bundle over the sphere with the connection that has the right monodromy? And this connection only has fusion poles at the given points. Plumlj's theorem, theorem 3.2.1 in the book, basically says you can always find a regular system, a bundle with regular singularities, that's fusion almost everywhere, maybe except at one point.
And that Birkhoff-Grothendieck theorem is key here again.
Absolutely central. It tells you any holomorphic bundle over the sphere splits into a sum of line bundles, one all dollar abats, all plus LP doll, each with an integer degree. This decomposition is vital. It turns out, and this is theorem 5.1.1, that a fusion system with a given monodromy exists if and only if a specific related vector bundle, called T dollars in the book, is trivial. Trivial means it is the simplest possible structure, like all those degrees are zero.
Wow. So the existence question really boils down to whether this special bundle T dollars is trivial or not.
That's a major part of it, yes. And whether Philly dollar is trivial depends heavily on the properties of the monodromy representation itself. For example, theorem 5.2.1 explores how reducibility of the monodromy breaking into smaller parts impacts things. Sometimes reducibility actually prevents a fusion system from existing. There's also lemma 5.5.3 connecting parts of the monodromy to the solutions being linearly independent. Gets quite detailed.
And the book even gives a complete answer for dimension 3 systems.
Yes. Theorem 6.1.1 does exactly that for PPR 32%. It says you get a negative answer, no fusion system without apparent singularities, precisely when the monodromy is reducible. The individual monodromy matrices have a specific Jordan block of form, and a related 2D part is irreducible and has a positive fusion weight. It shows just how specific the conditions can be.
And I suppose the examples in Chapter 7 help make all this less abstract. Things like the Euler equation, Bessel functions.
Exactly. Those examples are crucial. They take these theoretical concepts, fusion points, regular points, exponents, monodromy, and show you how they play out in equations people actually work with. You can see, okay, this equation has a logarithmic term, so it's regular, but not fusion here. Or you can calculate the exponents for the Bessel equation and see how they relate to its parameters. It grounds the theory.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? How this one problem, Hilbert's 21st, pulls together ideas from complex analysis, topology, thinking about loops, group theory, representation theory, and even algebraic geometry with these vector bundles.
It really is a crossroads of mathematics. For over 100 years, the Riemann-Hilbert problem has been this focal point, driving research in so many different directions. And while, you know, the original question maybe didn't have the simple yes answer Hilbert hoped for without adding apparent singularities, the journey to understand why has generated so much deep mathematics and so many powerful tools.
So let's try to wrap up the key takeaways. We've seen the Riemann-Hilbert problem has this interesting, slightly indirect history with Riemann and Hilbert. We've got the crucial difference between fusion systems, the stricter kind Hilbert asked for, and the broader class of regular systems where Plenelge made that early breakthrough.
Right. And the big challenge, finding purely fusion systems isn't always possible without those apparent singularities.
Exactly. And we saw how this whole problem can be elegantly reframed using the language of vector bundles and connections, where theorems like Birkhoff-Grothendieck become really important. So hopefully this dive has shed some light on why this problem is so significant, the cool ideas involved, without, you know, completely burying everyone in the math.
Absolutely. And it does make you wonder, doesn't it? This core idea, understanding and controlling how functions or systems behave near critical points, near singularities, you have to think about where else that applies, like in physics with phase transitions or engineering with system instabilities, points where things change drastically.
That's a great point.
Could the kinds of mathematical structures and techniques developed for Riemann-Hilbert, you know, offer insights into those kinds of real-world critical behaviors? It's something to ponder.
Definitely something to ponder. Maybe a topic for another deep dive down the road. For now, thanks so much for joining us on this exploration into the Riemann-Hilbert problem. We hope it's piqued your interest and maybe given you a new perspective on the power and connections within mathematics.